Hey, it's me, Brian Reeves. Have you ever considered working with a coach? Like maybe you've achieved success on the outside, but deep fulfillment is still missing inside? Or you're confronted with a massive challenge or choice in your life? Or your relationships aren't as fulfilling as you want them to be? Or maybe you're just tired of trying to figure life out all by yourself? Well, I invite you to apply for private one-on-one coaching with me. Since 2012, I've helped 1,000 men and women like you break through hidden barriers, deepen their relationships, especially the relationship with themselves, and step more fully into the life they were meant to live. Coaching isn't about getting advice. It's about deep transformation so that you can really hear and trust the wisdom and clarity already always within you. I only take on a few clients at a time, and I only work with men and women truly ready to do the work. So if you're up for an inner adventure as a pathway to meaningful change in your outer world, go to brianreeves.com/coaching, click an application link on that page to apply. That's Brian Reeves, Brian with a Y, reeves.com/coaching. The breakthrough you need could begin today. All right, let's get into today's episode. Today on Men This Way, my guest is the author Sophie Strand. A few months ago, I picked up Sophie's book, The Flowering Wand, Rewilding the Sacred Masculine. And within just a few minutes of reading it, my mind was being blown wide open. I love mythology and the wisdom and the teaching stories found within. I believe our world is starving for myth stories that revitalize our spirit. And I think that's why many people are prone today to place, for example, certain politicians and business leaders at the center of hero mythologies in which those leaders are saviors destined by God to save us from some imagined dragons. We're starving for myths. We humans are storytelling machines. Our worlds are literally built by the stories we tell and believe in. In Sophie's book, The Flowering Wand, she brings alive ancient mythological stories and characters, from the vegetal wine god Dionysus to the Arthurian magician Merlin, from Tom Bombadil, the obscure Lord of the Rings character who offers the hobbits a magical moment of respite from their arduous hero's journey to throw that little golden crazy ring into the fires of Mordor, also to Jesus and the devil. Sophie offers us new lenses through which to see and understand these epic figures. Now, I gotta say, this is one of those conversations in which I kind of feel like a child sitting at the feet of a masterful storyteller in a public library, like asking her to tell me the stories and then tell me about the stories. I don't feel prepared for this conversation. Not because I didn't do my prep work, but because the subject we tackle here is so rich and profound and vast. And I know in advance I will only be able to scratch at the shallow surface of what's available here. And truthfully, my heart hurts knowing that. Like, Sophie's work is one of those rare works that awakens something primal in me, something ancient, that lives outside of time, that recalls me of my infinite nature, my indestructible connection to everything. It's an enlightening read, to say the least. Just a quick bio. Sophie Strand is a writer based in the Hudson Valley in New York who focuses on the intersection of spirituality, storytelling, and ecology. She was raised by house cats, puffballs, possums, raccoons, and an opinionated crippled goose. And in every neighborhood she's ever lived in, she's been known as the walker. She believes strongly that all thinking happens interstitially. I love this part of her bio. She believes strongly that all thinking happens interstitially between beings, ideas, differences, mythical gradients. Beautiful. One more thing. My co-host, Tate Arend, isn't with us today. Now he'll be back in the next episode. Now I invite you to take a deep breath and stay present with us all the way through to the end of this epic episode of Men This Way. All right, let's dive.
Who am I now? I didn't write this story. I didn't write who I was as a man. I just was kind of floating around aimlessly. I didn't have a circle of men that I trusted. That energetic connection with your brothers is something that's really important.
What is required from us in order to meet our partner, raise a family, or whatever it might be, emotional connection, emotional depth, we are taught is not associated with masculinity.
And I've been in men's work for a long time. One of the common themes, as you know, is that men don't trust men and they don't have anyone that they can really respect and revere. I can't go do it on my own. I've got to be a lone wolf. The benefit of actually forging real friendships and real brotherhood where you can trust people and you can belong. The result of that, man, is amazing connections in my life, amazing business opportunities, collaborations, adventure.
What I needed, masculine support. I needed other men to be a stand for what I wanted, hold me accountable for what I was trying to do. I knew that I could not do this journey alone.
Welcome to Men This Way with Brian Reeves and Tate Arendt. Sophie Strand, I am so excited to have you on Men This Way. Welcome to my show, Men This Way. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Brian. And I know it's been kind of like a meandering route to get here. So I just want to say thank you for being so accommodating of all of the uncertainty in planning this conversation.
Oh, 100%. You know, when I first picked up your book, it was only maybe 3-4 months ago, The Flowering Wand, specifically that book. It was given to me on a recommendation by a man that I'm in a men's group with. He had just held it up on a call that we were on, and I saw, oh, that's interesting. And he was blown away by it. So I picked it up immediately. It really spoke to me, and I started reading it, and I too was just blown away by what I was reading. I mean, from the first chapter. And I just, you know, it's like, I want to take this time and just geek out with you and kind of fanboy on you a little bit here, Sophie, because, you know, and you know, even your acknowledgement though of being in, you know, like the language I like to use, being in partnership with this experience, you know, what your book speaks to a missing, I think, in particularly for many modern men's experiences, and I don't think that many men could articulate it, but it speaks to a missing connection with life, with nature, with existence, and you capture that so profoundly in your book. And you know, first off, Sophie, to be able to write so richly and profoundly about what, you know, the deepest longings of every man's heart and soul, connection and relatedness through the lens of mythological stories. You're surely familiar with Women Who Run With the Wolves. Yeah. One of the most magical books I've ever read. Mandatory reading for every man, woman, every being, I think, right? Like, you've written something that to me is in the lineage of that mastery. Like, that's, I don't use that word often to describe books, you know, Women Who Run With the Wolves, masterful. The Flowering Wand, Rewilding the Sacred Masculine, your book, masterful. And you're a young woman, and I'm blown away that you can write that. And just to be clear, my curiosity about that speaks more to like my Western productivity focused, nature disconnected education than to whether, you know, your youth or your sex or gender should enable you to write something like that, right? I'm just impressed. All right, enough, you know, fanboying on you here. Sophie, please take us into your story a little bit, right? Your background, like how did life prepare you to be able to, you know, I love, oh, there's so much richness here. So we're just getting started, but how did life prepare you to take this kind of material and squeeze the juice out of it the way that you have?
Isn't it that Kierkegaard quote that says like, life must be lived forwards, but only understood backwards. You know, I'm looking back at my life. I can see all of the strange things that were thrown on to the metaphorical compost heap of me that fermented me, that alchemized me into the place where I could possibly write this book. I always joke to people that this was never the book I would have ordered off the menu or planned to write. It was not something that was in the cards for me initially. I was born in an interfaith household. My parents write about the history of religion and spirituality. They're kind of eco-anarchists. My dad is an ex-Buddhist monk. My mom is kind of like a pagan witch. We grew up in the Catskills, rehabilitating wild raccoons and possums.
Wow.
They were very animist, which means they were very much interested in an ecological spiritual framework whereby everything is alive and alive differently than us in a way that provokes conversation with the, what I call the animate everything. So I had a very rich intellectual, ecological, spiritual upbringing where a lot of things were kind of thrown into the soup. We had rabbis, theologians, environmentalists, scientists at the dinner table. We also had wild cats and, you know, chipmunks and swans and geese inside our house. So it was really a melting pot of a lot of different things. I will say that I always wanted to be a writer of fiction. And I would say that I spent about 10 years researching and then finally writing a retelling of the Gospels from Mary Magdalene's point of view that sought to replant Yeshua and Miriam as they would have actually been known in their native Aramaic in the ecology, the political and anthropological pressures of Second Temple period Palestine, to really look at how Jesus gets mistranslated by the very empire that killed him and the women who supported the ministry, who made it so unique and who initially kept it alive, get written out of the text as they get translated through different empires, through different languages. And as I was doing that over many, many years inside and outside of academia, I became very interested in when does patriarchy become a bad thing, quote unquote? When does masculinity and patriarchy become conflated? You know, what are all these mythologisms that lead to the ecocidal anthropocentric culture that is destroying us, our relationships, and the earth today? When does that happen and why does that happen? And so I did like a deep mentorship with, I would say, the mythological structures of the Mediterranean basin and of Europe, really looking, going back 30,000 years, at what point do we begin to kind of step off the ecologically relational path? So I did that research for that novel. But then during quarantine, I was very sick. I was isolating. I was quarantining alone. I had a lot of pressures in my life that were making things very difficult. And that novel was getting rejected for being too long, too intellectual, too feminine, you know, lots of excuses. And now it's been very, very successful, but it was not getting published. And I was struggling with serious depression and serious illness. And I thought, I could keep myself alive. And I started posting essays. I thought to myself, you know, some of the people I love most in my life are men. And they're really, really struggling. And I have done my mentorship with the divine feminine. And I've been harmed by men in my life. And I've had that reaction formation where I stepped back and I didn't want to relate. And as I was quarantining alone, I thought this is a time to do some healing and to welcome other men who I love to the table to a conversation about what does it mean that masculinity, which is a biodiversity of many, many different things, has been conflated with the monomyth of patriarchy. How does that disadvantage all of us, no matter gender or sexual orientation, into healthy relating? And so I started posting these essays for free online. I had like a followership of 500, nothing. Within days, it had gone viral. And then within a month, I had written an entire book and the book had sold. In a certain way, it was really unplanned, light of foot, totally wild, and it saved my life.
Wow. You know, as a fellow writer, it really reminds me of my journey as well. I didn't set out to be in the work that I am, working with intimate relationships. And my book I wrote, Choose Her Every Day or Leave Her, was also born of just something like I needed to write something that was alive in me. I didn't have much of an audience at the time, but as soon as I started writing these essays, and this was back in 2012, 13, early blogger days, I noticed people really, the world hungered for this, and that turned into a whole thing. It took on a whole momentum. So I love the relatedness of our stories and the similarity. It's it is a beautiful thing that life has such a hand. You know, Sophie, I'm so aware in my programming, I'm coming from an old story. By it, when I say old story, I don't mean the oldest stories. I mean the old modern story, which is I've got to figure this out.
I did too. We're always fighting against that kind of internalized dominant culture. Yeah.
And there's a line that you wrote. I think it's the second paragraph. It's one line. It's its own paragraph. You know the line that I'm speaking to. It's one of the most profound lines I've read in my life, and because of the way that it speaks to something so deep in me as a man speaking. And before I speak to that, I also want to acknowledge that I thought many years ago I was in a mountain cabin in Idlewild, California. Just this was probably how long ago was this? This might have been 15 years ago or so. I was very lost. I was in between worlds. I didn't really know what to do with myself. And so I just went into the mountains and I was going to spend 30 days at a cabin and just have a little, you know, mini vision quest retreat. And it was a winter. There was a lot of snow that winter in the mountains here. And I think I went through 3 blizzards. It was glorious. It was fantastic because I didn't have to go anywhere. I loved it. But I had this moment where I thought, you know, I was recovering from a breakup, another breakup, you know, one after the other. And I had this moment of thinking, I really need to heal my relationship to feminine energy. Because I'm looking out, seeing all these broken relationships with women in my past. I'm 36. I'm 50 now. So yeah, that was like 14 years ago. And I went to a bookstore, and that's where I was asking the woman about, you know, how can I heal my relationship with feminine energy? What do you got? And there were a whole bunch of books she rolled out, and they were like, no, that's not it. That's not it. And then she brought me Women Who Run with the Wolves, tingles, electricity on my body. That's it. Well, long story short, what that book actually taught me is that healing my relationship to feminine energy, sure, but healing my relationship to masculine energy, I had never considered that before. And that was a path that I needed to walk, that I had never thoughtfully, intentionally walked before. And your line, so this is the line: do we want to hand the masculine a sword or a wand? I've been doing this work now for, you know, 14 years. Nobody's ever asked me that question. Nobody's ever posed that question. And yet it seems so fundamentally an essential question that we must ask. Can you take us into what that question really speaks to and why it matters so much that we ask it?
Definitely. So first, I want to offer that I wrote this book 4 years ago, and we change. Books are kind of fossils. They by virtue of written culture, you know, for most of human history, knowledge was transmitted orally. So it changed and adapted to shift ecological and social circumstances. But with books, something stays still. And there's a good thing about that. And then there are things that are not so good. One of them is that we change and we evolve past our work. And so I look back on that chapter with generosity to my past self and also updated ideas, which is, I don't know how helpful it is to present a false dualism or a choice, a binary. And I don't know if you heal binaristic thinking with more binaries, like sword or wand. So there's the kind of the gray area. However, what I wanted to talk about was this modern heroic individual where the sword represents material reductionism, cutting things down to parts, domination, ownership. It's not necessarily masculine. It's more a kind of a human-centric perspective, which is we cut things apart, we analyze. And if you take apart analyze and to the original Greek, it means to create knowledge through separation. And for me, analysis, diagnosis is also a similar word to divide, to know something by dividing it, to know that we are human by proving that we are different from animals and from our environment. And we've been on that path, that SWORD diagnostic analytic material reductionist, I think it's right brain perspective, for a really, really long time. And it has not fostered a very sustainable culture. We've really driven ourselves into a corner. And so for me, the SWORD really represents the heroic individual, the person, the species that dominates other species, other people, and goes at it alone and goes to, you know, conquers the dragon, saves the maiden, and proves themselves. And for me, the heroic individual is actually such an onerous responsibility. Don't we want to be entangled and related and creating community, and so that we don't have to carry everything on our shoulders? So for me, the wand is about drawing connections, that we see that wands are perhaps one of the oldest atropaic, I think is the word, which is they create spells of protection. They ward off evil. They're, you know, all you need is a branch with leaves or like a flowering stalk, and it's a wand. And you can wave it in the air to create a kind of a gesture, an invitation. We have the water dowsing sticks. Wands are actually a male inheritance. It's much older than the sword. The sword, as we think of it today, is actually only perfected during the Roman Empire for executing slaves, which is such an interesting thing. And I think we fit in a very narrow modern context. We think of masculinity and violence as being conflated, but the truth is that the much older male inheritance is one of healing and connection and prophecy and music and healing. And that's much more a male inheritance than division and oppression and violence.
Yeah, I mean, you speak to, I think the way that the reason that sentence or that question, and I so appreciate, you know, disclaimer is not the right word, but you're illuminating what a book is, right? It is a fossil of sorts. I know I've written things that, you know, I've written two books. My first book, I don't know that I would write that book again. I probably wouldn't. I certainly wouldn't write it the same way, I hope. And even my newest book, there are things. So I really appreciate that. And still, I think that question, the reason though, I do think that question still serves in the way that it's asked, is because all I've known is how to handle a sword my whole life. I think all men know is how to handle a sword. We don't even realize, even as I was contemplating this, even a wand in a lot of our literature and movies, even a wand is used like a sword often, you know, to shoot down enemies, to pierce them with something. And one of the great crises that men are experiencing is isolation and loneliness. Right. And so I think that's such a profound question. And I agree. I don't want to lose my capacity to wield a sword. That's a fact.
We want to get off the menu. Yeah. I mean, I there are different tools for different moments, you know, but I think that the wand, for me, the wand was really inspired by Dionysus's thyrsus, which was probably a flowering fennel stalk. And it would ignite people into kind of ecstatic dance and ritual, to take down their hair, you know, social class boundaries would dissolve. So for me, the wand is really Dionysus's thyrsus, which dissolves hierarchy and classism and species divide.
Mm. Well, you beautifully illustrate how, and I do see in things like Harry Potter and where a wand also turns humans into animals. That's common, right? It's a bit bridging the nature disconnect that so many of us are living with. We literally become nature with the you know, the fluid flick of a wand. And so I'm struck by, you know, I want to talk about Dionysus for a moment, because there's this passage. Now, just to my listener, I want you to know, the one listening, and Sophie, I want you to hear this as well. Like, my brain is so lit up by what you've written Sophie. Like truly, it's one of these rare books that has just lit up all my circuits. I feel like such a neophyte, you know, at the feet of a master work that, you know, just the first chapter, I've read it over and over and over, trying to really grasp and grok the wisdom in it and the beauty in it and the things that you stir up inside of me. And so if I apologize to my listener, if my brain wants to go a million different places. And
let's do it. I mean, I think that's right. We're not on the hero's journey. We're in the wild dance. Yeah,
we're in the wild dance, finding our way, indeed, in the forest, walking. So there's this, as you begin to talk about looking at the more ancient myths, right, that humans have been telling throughout time, predating monotheistic patriarchal thinking as well, and where there's only one God and it's a man and et cetera, that there was this wild pantheon of gods, of you know, masculine or male gods that gave us so many more flavors of being and expression I think I'm a pretty thoughtful man. I'm a pretty thoughtful, introspective man. And I came through the military, though, you know, raised up a boy in this culture. I feel so cut off from so many aspects of being. And it's painful. It's painful. So you can take us into that awakening, or that you know, what you see in the pantheon of gods that gave us men, males, the masculine, so much more expression than we have today.
Oh, I think one of the most amazing things is this book doesn't really end. It was more like an opening. Like, since finishing it, there have been so many myths and ideas and things that have been sent to me by other people. Like, it's just the ecosystem is growing. And the metaphor I always use is ecosystems are resilient in as much as they have more connectivity, more species, more complexity. And, you know, tree farms or monocropping like we do is actually really, really dangerous. It's very susceptible to funguses, to weather events, that you actually create a more resilient ecosystem when you have more species. And so I think the same is true for masculinity, that masculinity is healthier the more archetypes it has. And it used to have so many more. I mean, as I went back through, you know, I followed the tree of like messianic Jesus, of monotheism back into the fertile soil. And I found underneath what looked like a single stalk, a single mushroom, a mycorrhizal system of many different connections, a much healthier root system below ground in deep history of different masculine archetypes. I mean, to share a couple that crop up all the time, one of them is the magician. The magician is a ecotone between the world of men and the world, the more than human world, that goes in. This is the man who plays music, who learns how to be a man, not by being a man, but transforming himself into the minds of animals and plants, who dream to plants. We see Joseph the Dreamer in Genesis. We see Merlin, Taliesin, Emergen, we see Orpheus, these magical, musical men who provide deep spiritual and political wisdom by crossing the boundary into the world of plants and animals. And so for me, the magician, I mean, one of the oldest cave art paintings we have is something called a theriomorph. It's called the Trois Frères Shaman, or spirit worker, as I call it. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I don't.
You'll love it. Look it up. It was found in France. It's one of the oldest paintings we have of a human form, except it's human. It's a man with, you know, male member, but he has the lower half of a deer. He has antlers. He has claws. He has an owl face.
Yeah.
And for me, the real power of the masculine is the place where it steps out of the human into the more than human, where it becomes symbiotic with other animals and other species. And so that was really an opening for me.
Well, before you go on, I'm thinking of you know, thinking of like shamans in indigenous cultures, they're, you know, often, but not always men that spent time, not time, but became nature in order to communicate back to humans, right? They've crossed that divide and can go back and forth between the unseen realms and the human realms. And I think of our modern culture, I think of, you know, Western culture, this country, our magicians, we don't have shamans. We make fun of shamans, and our magicians are relegated to, you know, sideshows at the circus or at your kid's birthday party, just pulling rabbits out of hats. You know, at or best.
Our magicians have had to take on different hats. They've become musicians. They've become teachers, but, you know, they're not given their primacy in the culture. They're not, you know, these are the men that know, you know, King David could be called a magician because he read spiritual signs in the flipping of leaves. If you actually look at the ways in which he has divine guidance, it's always through this ability to read nature. And so it's not that our magicians have become these sideshow characters. It's that we haven't given them their place in the center of our council. You know, we need men who have this ecological openness to be running things, to be sitting at the table with other people. And yet these are the men who are laughed at and who are looked down upon, who are considered to be too feminine. And yet they were the most masculine in other cultures. They were the kings, they were the prophets, they were the storytellers, the bards, the spirit workers. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, where is Dionysus? Can you speak to him? Where is he gone in our modern world?
I think Dionysus is such a trickster. So for the listener who hasn't read my book, Dionysus predates even the Greek pantheon. So he's older even than the Greek gods. And by the time he arrives in Rome and he's renamed Bacchus, he's actually seen as being very dangerous. So he gets a bad paint job. He gets a smear job done by the Romans to become the drunk wino. But the truth is that he actually is initially on Crete in the earliest version of Greek, Linear B. He is the god of the vine, fermentation, dance, and destroying hierarchy. Whenever he comes unexpectedly, he dissolves boundaries. He was the inspiration behind the two almost successful revolts against the Roman Empire, that of a witch called Pecula Anya and Spartacus, whose partner was a Dionysian priestess. And so Dionysus, his other name was Liber, which is the root of the word for liberation, libation and liberation. So he was always characterized as a stranger, as the outsider who was coming in for the slaves, the outcasts, the women, the magicians. He was there not for the kings. He was there to flip the table and to put the outsiders back in their rightful place. So I think I always say that you can look to your environment for Dionysus. Dionysus is the ivy and the vine. He was always associated with vegetation that either gives you a psychedelic state, altered consciousness, or destroys buildings. Ivy will, you know, digest a building from the outside.
Wow.
And so I say, look to the species in your environment that the dominant conservation paradigm says are bad. You know, we have this very fictional idea of the climactic ecosystem, you know, but the truth is evolution means that things are always changing. As the climate changes, different species have to come in to adapt. And so I think that, you know, in my ecosystem, the grapevine, the honey fungi, the knotweed, there are a bunch of invasive species that have come in and are changing things, and we can demonize them, or we can say that they are the stranger Dionysus coming in to shake up the dominant order so that we develop a new type of relating, a new type of dancing that will help us to survive on chaos we can't predict.
Well, I want to stay here for a moment because you reference Joseph Campbell's hero's journey, right? In this regard, in the sense that Dionysus, when he shows up, he doesn't show up as a hero going on a journey. He shows up already complete, right? And, you know, I look at my own journey in life, and I've been on so many hero's journeys, and I'm grateful and wonderful and fine and fun and all that. But, you know, Sophie, I'm 50. I just turned 50 a few months ago. Not that that's in and of itself anything interesting, but I'm at a stage in my life where just going on another so-called hero's journey doesn't ring true for me. In fact, I've been struggling in my life in the last few years to connect with a new dream, a new vision. You know, I've accomplished so much. I mean, I've got an amazing wife. I've got, you know, the dog I always wanted. I'm doing work that I love, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, culture tells me essentially there's just go on another hero's journey. I don't know, make more money, have more impact. It's like a more, do something, you know, climb a new mountain kind of thing. And so Dionysus features prominently throughout your book. And I think one of the things that I'm also present to is I don't really know how to have fun anymore. I don't know how to play.
I mean, I think so my mother writes a lot about the history of religion as well. And one thing we talk about a lot. So have you read the book Dancing in the Streets by Barbara Ehrenreich?
No.
Fantastic book. One of my favorites. She was an incredible nonfiction journalist. And it's about how the history of dancing and revelry, the minute we stop communally celebrating and shift into more kind of hierarchic, ritualistic religion, we become more depressed and we start living in a way that's very unsustainable. And so play, I think, unstructured play, revelry, rather than the kind of white knuckled, obsessive compulsive ritual where it's like, if I do this, I'll stay alive. If I go on this journey and accomplish this thing, I get to live another day. You know, there's a scarcity mentality, a rigidity to it that I think is born of our control culture. And it's not generous to any of us. I mean, for me, it's what I really struggle with it. I've been asking myself recently, am I satisfiable? Can I enjoy what I have today? Or do I have to be constantly going on more quests? Dionysus kind of calls BS on that. He says, just throw a party, yeah. Do something wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I mean, there's this beautiful, idea that I learned in just my studies of ecology in the last few years. I'm a big fan of Bill Plotkin. You familiar with his work?
Yes.
Yeah. Nature and the Human Soul. Oh my goodness. Another just masterwork, a Bible of sorts for me. And there's this line, everything in the forest is the forest. Everything in the forest is the forest. You know, I've brought that idea to my men's groups at times. And again, it's lit up. It has just lit up the space in a way that really excites our imaginations and our, you know, it shifts our way of being in a sense, you know, or at least our orientation to where that's how we're wanting to be. And again, this is like the greatest struggle of my life is to embrace the forest I'm living in and my place in it. Right. And that's an unfamiliar quest, if you will. I mean,
it's really, I would say the past 6 months of my life, I've been like, my life is now. It's not happening tomorrow.
Yeah.
it's here. This is the forest. Yeah, it's so hard because our whole culture is about futurism. It's about kind of paying something forward.
Yeah, achieving something or when I get XYZ or do XYZ, then I'll be complete, happy. Then I can throw the party.
Then I can throw the party. No, you got to do it now. I mean, nothing, no tomorrow is certain. You know, you don't want to waste the day. I'm bad at that too. I mean, I think my whole life, especially I've dealt with very serious illness. And I think initially the hero's journey and the healing journey are very intertwined in our culture, which is You know, if you're sick, you have to go to the underworld and then come back up and heal and then tell your story of how you got better. And as someone who has a condition that doesn't have a cure, I always feel like I'm failing the hero's journey. I'm failing the healing journey and I'm failing the hero's journey. And I can't celebrate, I can't relax until I somehow am healed. And I had to, it was actually, it's so interesting. I really love this book. This book critiques the hero's journey, but I have to say I owe so much to Joseph Campbell and I love him. And I think he's one of my biggest inspirations. And it was actually his work he did about Tristan and the Tristan and Isolde myth that was really helpful for me. So Tristan and Isolde is one of my favorite mythic stories. Love triangle predates the Arthurian myths. There are even ideas that it comes from Persia. Who knows where it's from? But Tristan is always, he's always kind of trying to exit the hero's journey. He's jumping off the cliffs. He's kind of suicidal. He's taking on battles that he knows he can't win because he just doesn't want to live out the tragedy. He just wants to take a break. And it was reading about Tristan that I realized I was like, I need to take a break from the hero's journey of completion, wholeness, healthiness, vitality, and just be.
You know, my wife and I, we've been going through the last couple of years a journey of attempting, trying to have a child. And life has not made that easy for us. And in a way, and I've written about this. This isn't news to anyone that's following my work. You know, we're thoughtful about how we talk about it and share it because we're still in the midst of it. But as it turns out, we probably cannot have a child together. And that's been, there's been that. I've also I'm estranged from my birth father, for the last year, and you know, it's interesting. All that I've been through has really also helped me. That and more. Also, it's taken me out of the hero's journey of sorts because, you know, so many people when they hear about our fertility challenges, they want to give us the solution.
Right.
They want to rush to, well, have you tried this? Well, I know this doctor or I know this person. They're unconventional. You got to give them a call. They'll sort you out. And, you know, when I emailed you yesterday before this interview, I wanted to send you the link. And I asked you a question. I said, I hope you're feeling well and you're up for the rigors of a podcast conversation. And then I'm doing my research and I read something you had shared, I don't know, 6 months ago or so about how when people revisit you, they say, I hope you're feeling better. As if right now you have to put on the performance of you've arrived somewhere, you've overcome something, you've accomplished better. And I went back and I looked at my email and I was like, oh God, I hope I didn't ask that question. Well, but I'm thoughtful of these things. And I'm also myself being on a particular journey that doesn't have a necessary satisfying conclusion. Even people want to just rush to, we'll just adopt, we'll just, you know, just do this. And the fact that my wife and I will never be able to have a child that is made of us two is unresolvable. That doesn't get to come to completion except as an acceptance of what is.
I sometimes think about indigestibility. I think about how multicellular life is the product of two bacteria who were starving, who tried to cannibalize each other mutually and both failed. Either had metabolized the other, we wouldn't have the complex cells with nuclei and mitochondria that we have today. So our very physical, corporal reality today is due to indigestibility, the inability to integrate, to complete, or to break something down. And I think about in my life, these things that don't resolve, don't get fixed, as actually being an invitation to collaborate in becoming something quite new. It's only through going through it myself that I've realized how callous I've been. It's not callous, it's just that our culture doesn't like to stay with things that it can't understand. And mortality, all of these things are scary to a culture that wants to accelerate into ease. And we can all help each other, I think, stay with these irresolvable things that just can't be broken down or digested. And yeah, I mean, the way I do that is through stories and through these myths. They help me. They really help me in these moments.
Yeah, they help me as well. And one of the stories that you shared that I found great solace in your book as well is the story of Tom Bombadil.
Oh yeah, I love Tom.
The old obscure Lord of the Rings character. I don't know why. I found such just sort of simple joy and appreciation, right? Tom Bombadil, for people who don't know him, and I've seen the movies, but I may have read a book or two, but again, I would have skipped right over him most likely in my, you know, immature view of things. But I love that how he's described as like time outside of time, right? He's a respite for the hobbits. He's a respite for them to come out of the quest that they're on, and be in this sort of suspended place that is peaceful. Hey, can you take us into the message of Tom Bombadil and like, you know, particularly in the light of what you and I are even talking about now?
I'll put it in this framework, which is something that me and my friends and family talk about. It's a long story. And the long story is the story of many, many different extinction events where you have a bottleneck. Most species die. Ecological niches are opened up, and then the survivors repopulate and diversify. And the millions of years of species dying, collaborating, moving. And when you weave yourself back into that kind of long body, long story, suddenly your single life feels held within a much bigger story than just a single species or a single life. And by virtue of metabolic looping, we're rebuilt from the very carbon that was in a pterodactyl, that was in carboniferous swamps, that we are the resurrection of ancient materials, that we are part of, our bodies are an ode to these lost ecosystems. And for me, Tom Bombadil, in the story of the Fellowship, where he arrives, he is posited as being, he saw the first acorn, the first rainfall. He's older than even the earth. He's older and outside of even the gods and Iluvatar, like the Tolkien's god. He's deeper and older. He's like cosmos itself. He's that embrace that says, yeah, you failed at that little thing. Yeah, that didn't happen, but you are part of a drama that is more magisterial, beautiful, and generous than a single life. And I think for me, that is, it's that deep time pulse, that Tom Bombadil table, where everyone gets to take a break from their singular human suffering and achievements and say, I'm part of a drama that I'm too small to ever see. I just have to trust that I'm part of it. And so for me, Tom Bombadil's table is about saying, like, sing, enjoy what you have, be together, take a break. You know you're going to have to take the ring to Mordor eventually. You'll have to live your human life. But you are also part of something much older and much bigger.
Yeah, and I think that's so comforting. It's comforting in a very visceral, primal, ancient way, really. It reminds me of, it's like I'm drawn to awe-inspiring wilderness, and perhaps many of us are, because it puts me in my place. You know, it reminds me of just how it's a paradox, really, because it reminds me of how little and small I am and how much I don't matter and how much I am absolutely the totality of everything at the same time. I'm connected to everything.
I mean, my favorite example in my own life is at the start of quarantine, I've been through a terrible breakup. I was quarantining alone and I was walking and I was outside a lot alone. And as I was doing that, I oftentimes look for animal guides to kind of, you know, teach me something. And I was hoping for a sexy one, like a hawk or a coyote or something. And it ended up being a woodchuck. Woodchucks, no matter where I went, arrived. And it got to the point where, like, I was leaving them food. I was always seeing them. And I thought, what is this? What's happening? And then I was driving home on basically a highway. And it was hailing and storming in, like, late spring. It was wild. And there was a woodchuck that was stuck at the dividing line, or like the dividing rail. And it was shivering, and it was not going to be able to get back in any direction through the traffic and make it. And I didn't think. I slammed the car into park. I jumped out. I went like this. The woodchuck jumped into my hands, which for anyone who knows wild animals is like very unusual. And I carried it across the road and put it into the undergrowth. And of course, people are screaming at me. I could have been hit. And I didn't think. I had been primed by all of these encounters with woodchucks to be ready for that moment. And I thought to myself, I was like, oh, what if that's why I was here? What if I'm not the main character? What if my whole life was about preparing me and putting me in place so that I could save woodchuck? What if I'm the side character and that was Frodo? You know? Not knowing is actually kind of nice.
It's a liberation.
Yeah.
The not knowing, I find. And again, one of my daily challenges, practices I lean into is, okay, I don't know. I don't know what's going on here. As tempted as I am to believe that I know and capable of convincing myself that I do know. Yeah. One of the, well, you know, I say theme, but really at the core of this book, I think at the core of so much of your work, well, specific to this book, since we're really on the talking about the sacred masculine, rewilding the sacred masculine, right? That's the subtext of your subtitle of The Flowering Wand. It's the theme of making, of helping the masculine become relational again. You mentioned it earlier in our conversation, the animate everything.
Yeah.
Right. I've been studying a more animism lately. I, for me, the question of whether it's true or not is irrelevant. It's like, is it useful? Is it connecting? Is it attuning us? Does it bring us into the moment, or does it take us away from the moment, et cetera? Again, so much of the work that I have done, both personally as a man coming out of the military, and that I work with men, is like helping us come back into our bodies, right? The military separated me from my body, chopped me off at the head, and turned me into, and it was only doing what society had been working at for years anyway, right? It was only perfecting in a sense. And interestingly, it was a mushroom that helped me come back into my body, right? Mushrooms, psilocybin, has been a very vital medicine for me over the years to help me feel my body again, come back into my body, be present in this moment. And so, you know, this is at the core of your work, this nature connection. And another story that you speak to, I know we'll start wrapping up here before in the next few minutes, but it's the story of Narcissus. Right, the retelling or reframing, reorienting of that story, whereas Narcissus is typically a cautionary tale. Don't fall in love with yourself. You know, get over yourself. Don't fall in love with your own image. I mean, narcissist has become a buzzword in the culture that people are using left, right, and center to dismiss people as somehow bad or non-relational. And I found it really interesting, your retelling of that. Would you just take us briefly into another lesson that we can take from that story?
Sure. I haven't read that chapter in a long time, but I think for me, it's so funny that you also bring up the fact that narcissism has become such a pop psychology way of, like, wholesale canceling someone. Instead of engaging with people who are complicated, who don't relate in the way that we relate, instead of being curious and really trying to widen our capacity for people who don't work like we work, we just say that they're a narcissist. And for me, it's actually become kind of like a red flag. If someone calls someone else a narcissist, I'm like, But
right, yeah.
But for me, the story of Narcissus is very much about vanity and about our culture plays it like it's about vanity, but really what it's about is looking into the water and seeing ourselves in the wider world, seeing ourselves reflected in the leaves, the worms, the tadpoles, the lotus pads, you know. And something very interesting for me is there's this injunction against anthropomorphism. So in a very Euro-patriarchal Western framework, in the kind of modern scientism, which is like not scientific, but it's the dominant idea of what science is. In a modern scientism, you're told not to personify other beings, plants, animals, insects, because you are projecting, like Narcissus, your reflection onto something else and falling in love with it. So if you pretend like a bat has feelings or a tree has feelings, you're anthropomorphizing them. Now, I want to call BS on that, because actually what we've done is divide ourselves off from thinking that anything else is real other than us, that it's actually a covert way of becoming truly narcissistic, thinking that we're the only conscious beings, the only alive beings. And if you look at indigenous cultures the world over, one of the ways of relating to other beings is by calling them people. They're the rock people, they're the tree people, the whale people, the salmon people, and by anthropomorphizing them into stories that allow you to relate to them. That I actually think anthropomorphization is, it fails at understanding the exact sensory experience of another being. But what it does, it uses your limited physical and emotional capacity to wonder curiously what another being might be feeling. And so for me, that's the real paradigm flip we can do with Narcissus, which is, well, maybe we see our reflection in other beings, but does that help us care about them and take care of them? If it does, that's a good thing.
Yeah. Wow. Sophie, there's so many more questions I want to dive into.
Maybe we can continue this conversation at some other point. This has been so meaningful to me. Thank you, Brian.
I would really, really like that. I mean, I want to explore the connection between Dionysus and the devil, right? The history there. That's a rich conversation. I want to explore the high priestess and intuition. Oh, I got stories about people wielding the idea of intuition in a way that's not very connecting, let's say, you know, and the way that you bring that back into the body, and so many questions, so many things I want to explore with you. I suppose to maybe wrap this up, and yes, please, I would love to do a part two sometime. Also for the people that are listening, in my preparation for this interview, I this morning, and Sophie, I told you this before we started recording, I literally in my dreams was having coffee with you. We were sitting in the woods somewhere talking about all this stuff. Like, it's alive in me. Your work has awakened something in me, that something new and ancient, and it's beautiful, and I'm grateful. I suppose just to wrap this conversation up, if I'm a man, I'm reading your book, or I'm stepping into your work for the first time, because that's will be the case for probably the vast majority of my audience. What do you want me to know?
What I want you to know is that I am a lover, not an expert, and that I follow what I love, and I trust that, like a bee, follow its appetite, its desire into the flower for nectar, I will incidentally pollinate something. And that if the more I follow my love and the more playfully, without the kind of rigidity of expertism, I follow it, the more people will join into the Dionysian revel. The Dionysus never shows up alone. He shows up with leopards, with satyrs, with maenads, with lots of people. And I think that I just want us all to become lovers again, to approach each other and the world, not through rigidity, but through courtship and play. And if you enter my work, know that I am wrong about so much and I'm always changing. And the most important thing is that I want to keep talking to people. People like you who are humble and curious and alive.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much. Next Tuesday, I'm going on a little mini vision quest. I'm going to my cabin in the woods. It's a renewal thing I have to do, a composting thing that I have to do I should do it every year. It's been a few years, and that's probably why I'm a little grumpy in my life right now. I haven't done that. So next Tuesday, I'm going to a cabin for 6 days. I'm going to spend 3 of those days in one spot in the woods, just listening, right? Being still, looking open to my nature teachers all around me. And I'll be bringing your book with me. I'll be bringing so many questions. And Sophia, I'll be watching your work. I'm so excited to just see what you continue to, you know, the myths and the stories that you continue to compost for us and to allow them to reemerge in new forms and new inspirations. And I absolutely intend to have you on Men This Way again. Thank you so much. Where can our listeners find you and your work?
Well, this has been such a, you know, I told you this before we came on, but this is my first podcast I've done in a long time. And it just was so lovely. So thank you. You can find me on Instagram at Cosmogony, Cosmogyny. I do a Substack where I offer a lot for free and then a lot also for paid. SophieStrand.substack.com. I'm updating my author's page with a new course probably in the next month or so. SophieStrand.com. And I have an upcoming book, which is The Body is a Doorway, which is about chronic illness and decoupling.
Sophie, thank you so much for being on Men This Way. This is an absolute pleasure. I look forward to next time.
Thank you so much, Brian.